Welcome to the Lovejoy Hour, sponsored by Cooker, 100 degree boiling hot water straight from your kitchen tap. I want to thank them as always for supporting my podcast. They're good people, great tech. As you know, I love it, and a great company. If you can afford one, I would recommend them. For more details and to look at all the designs, go to cooker.co.uk. Cooker spelled Q-U-O-O-K-E-R.co.uk. On today's hour, I'm curious about what it's like to be in Lord of the Rings, which is a super franchise. Joining me to talk about this and his life is Owain Arthur, who plays the part of Dwarvian Prince Durin IV in Lord of the Rings, the Rings of Power series on Amazon Prime. Now, the Rings of Power TV show will cost Amazon over $1 billion, with the first season alone costing a staggering $462 million. That is a lot of money. They're spending a lot of money on this. It's big time. Let's speak to him and see what it's like to work in one of these franchises. Owain, thank you so much for joining me today. How are you?
I'm very well, thank you, sir. How are you?
Yeah, very good, thank you. Very good. Have you been enjoying doing the PR for the Rings of Power?
Do you know what? I'm kind of looking back, reflecting on it all now, and it was a really busy few weeks. And I've never been involved in something that big before, and I enjoyed it. Yes, I was a bit frustrated that I was in hotel rooms all the time, because I just wanted to go out and see the cities I visited. But I have to say, New York was so cool. It was just so cool.
Yeah, you did a bit of a. I was going to say to you, actually, do you like all the trimmings of being an actor in something as huge as the Rings of Power, Lord of the Rings? Because yeah, when I became a TV presenter, the bit I really enjoy doing is when people say, whenever there's something out from the show or I have to do some PR of some description, I really enjoy doing PR. I think it's quite funny when people are sitting asking me questions about the crap I'm doing. And I enjoy traveling to people's studios. I like all the bits and bobs with it. I think it's, you know, as the trimmings, as I like to call them. Do you like all the trimmings? Which go
Do you know what? And there's been a lot of trimmings with this, I have to say. The bits that I've kind of gone, this isn't real life, is kind of when you're walking around with security and you've got these guys. For instance, that my first kind of experience of it was out in Comic-Con in San Diego, and we were being shuttled everywhere. There's 20 of us, so there's big buses or there's massive what do they call them, Escalades, big SUVs, with a security person in each car, and you're going in a convoy. You almost feel like the president when you're going around San Diego. And there was one point where we were having a company meal just across the street to our hotel. And there was about three or four security guys just walking with us, and they had these earpieces in. Very obviously security guys, do you know what I mean? It was just me and my mate Tristan Gravel, both from Wales, both talking Welsh to each other in this, you know, fest in San Diego, and then security kind of putting their arms out whilst crossing a zebra crossing, and he's just kind of go, well, it's a bit excessive, isn't it? But also a little bit secretly, you kind of go, this is cool. Do you know what I mean? Kind of, it's silly, but also like funny and cool. Silly makes you feel important, and of course. Yeah. You're not. You know what I mean? It's just.
Well, it's funny actually, because I spoke to someone not so a few years ago, and he was involved a lot in the music industry. And he says the reason why sort of pop stars at the time he was talking about, I think he was talking about Girls Aloud, who were quite big. So it was quite a few years ago. And he said the reason why they get in a car and they go like two blocks to the shops and then they get out and they get in another security car, a lot of it's to do with image, you know. You've spent a lot of money. I mean, we were talking about the money and just in the intro there, you know, it's gonna be $1 billion on this. When you spent $1 billion, you wanna make your stars look like they're important. So you've got to throw some security guards in there and some tinted glass, you know, always. I will tell you something funny. I used to tour with bands a lot years ago. and I used to be a swag man, so I used to sell t-shirts. And one of the tours I went on was Transvision Vamp. I don't know if you know them. They had a lead singer called Wendy James, a really good looking woman, bleached blonde hair. Anyway, what was their song? Baby, I Don't Care was the big one they had. And I remember being on tour with her, and we were all over Britain, and she had security everywhere. And then I think she lived near me, because when we got back off the tour, one day I opened the curtains or the blinds, or whatever, in my flat, and I looked out, and Wendy was at the bus stop waiting for a bus. she lived near me in Ladbroke Grove, I think. And I just thought, that's really funny that you've got, you know, security guards, blacked out Range Rovers, the whole shebang, and suddenly you're at a bus stop on the Monday.
This is it. Well, this is exactly it, because it kind of puts distance between you and it, really. It's kind of when you're going and doing all of these things, it's something else. It's something other. It's kind of part of the fun fair, if you know what I mean. And kind of, and you know, you come back home and you just wash, you know, you've been away for 3 weeks, you come back home and you have to wash 3 weeks worth of clothes, and it's like, well, you know, what a load of, I mean, what was all that? You know, you kind of look back and you go, no, this is reality. You got to take everything with a pinch of salt, I feel.
Yeah. I've never obviously done a junket thing, because I've never been an actor, but it does. I sometimes used to have to interview them on XFM. Like, people would come around and they'd be doing the circuit, and they'd end up in my studio because it was Leicester Square. And some of the times they'd be really pissed off, and they'd say, "Oh God, I'm being asked the same old questions time and time again." And I'd go, you know, I'd be sitting there thinking, mate, you're not digging holes in the road for a living. So, I mean, you're going around visiting the world, and you're in London, because there were Americans who would come in sometimes. And I just think, you know what, there's worse things to do than sit and have a conversation with someone. And as a star, you can always move the questions on, you know, because then everybody's looking for a different angle, aren't they? So if you start moving the question on, they go, I've got something more. It's just about having a conversation, isn't it?
Yeah, it's true. And you know what I said? I referenced those guys digging up holes on the motorways, and you know, filling in potholes and stuff. And I go, listen, and I had to, each time I heard like a grunt of going, oh God, how many have we got? And I just got, and I pride myself in being the one that raises that question to the others, and kind of go, you know, this, I've not had to dig up holes, but I've been a labourer before, you know what I mean? I've done those jobs.
Yeah, we'll get there in a minute, but you've been there and you've done it, and you've gone through it, not immediate success, so you understand it. We'll talk about that in a minute, but first of all, where did you go on the PR? Because when you came on Sunday Brunch, it seemed like you were in Mexico, weren't you, in New York? Where else did you go?
That's it. Well, we did, I suppose San Diego. LA and San Diego was like the first one we did, because that was part of the PR as well. The Comic-Con, the Holy Grail, apparently, you know, is San Diego. And then we did LA for 3 or 4 days, Mexico for 3 days, New York for 3 or 4 days, and then back into London. And one half of us went to Mumbai as well, so they had... I mean, they had a 30-hour flight, because they had delays and stuff as well. So, you know, I had the easy part of the tour, but yeah, it was cool. I loved. I mean, I'm just, as I'm talking to you here now, I'm looking at a wrestling mask that I got handed whilst in Mexico, and you just go, wow, I was in Mexico City with
that
all these.
So cool. I've been to every continent apart from South America. What's it like? What's Mexico City like? Is it mad?
Well, that was, neither had I, and Mexico City was my introduction to it. Unfortunately, I didn't get a chance to really explore the place. We got to go to the museum, and we had an explanation of how Mexico City is actually built on a lake. Did you know that?
No, I didn't know that.
Yeah, Mexico City's built on a lake. And we had...
Why doesn't it drown then? Why doesn't it fall in the lake?
Well, it does. It is. Apparently, the president's house is actually sinking. in that, in, you know, the, you know, the opening, I can't remember what Bond film it was, but there's a massive opening sequence in Mexico. The helicopter goes down through the square and stuff. Well, we did a little bit of junket in that hotel, and we were in that square, and we got to visit a church there, and yeah, you could see it was all sagging down because it is actually built on a lake. It was mental.
That's cool. Well, it's not cool. It's not cool that you know that, but it's not cool. Can I just correct myself, by the way? I said I've been to every continent apart from South America. I don't think I've been to Antarctica, though I did look into going to Antarctica, right? And I did look into it. And I was like determined to go there because I thought like 0.00001% of the like population of the world has probably ever been there. So I thought, I'm going to do this. I'm going to go there. I think it's like 25 grand or something to go there. And it's oh God, it's so much money because nothing goes there. So and if you want to properly, because I didn't want to go on a cruise. So you pick up a cruise in South America and then you go there and then you come back. And I thought, I don't want to be on a bloody cruise there. I want to like fly there. And so then, so then because I'm a bit mental, I thought, I wonder if I can just do some research. So I started looking up, can I go to Antarctica and pretend to research? Do you know what I mean? Yeah, that white stuff, snow. Yeah.
Oh, that's the yellow stuff. Don't touch that one.
Yeah. Oh, I see some penguins. Yeah, okay. let's talk about how you got the gig. And it must be, I mean, it must have been an amazing phone call when your agent said to you, you've got a part and a big part, a good part in The Lord of the Rings. Because The Lord of the Rings does not fail because, you know, it's tried and tested. Tolkien did a good job, I believe. he sort of understood the market. And obviously there's been the three films and there's been numerous other things about, and it all succeeds. So when you hear you're going to be in the new Amazon Prime show, what does it feel like to know, wow, this is pretty much, you know, you're signing for Man City, aren't you? That's what you're doing. You're going to win stuff.
Man City. Yeah, I suppose. I mean, I'm a United supporter, so
that's why I said it, because you're not winning if you're signing for United.
Well, you're not at the moment. That's true.
Maybe you'll turn around.
Yeah, we'll see. Come on, Man Hag, we can do it. it was. Do you know what? I mean, each time you get that phone call saying you've got the job, that is a buzz anyway. So to have it, to knowing that this was the biggest project I will have ever worked on. It was quite massive, and I called my mum and dad and sister. I put them all on a group chat and told them what was happening and that I was off to New Zealand and stuff. And that felt good. That was a nice feeling. That it kind of felt like, it did feel like a life-changing moment. You know, it is one of those jobs that you just go, oh my Christ, this is massive. And the buzz I got from that was quite spectacular. But then since that, you kind of go, right, I've got to do it now. You know, I've got to produce this now. So it was just kind of knuckling down and working hard and making the most of it, living each moment, knowing what I've got, knowing how lucky I am, and not taking anything for granted, because, you know, I'm getting on a bit now. I've been an actor since I was 11 and had these kind of life-changing jobs that kind of move you up a bit or give you a bit of recognition, if you like. So each time that happens, I've got to, I try and gain perspective on it and what it means to my life and how fortunate I am, and also kind of taking in that, do you know what, you worked hard for it. You've worked at the Albert Hall. You've, you know, been a labourer. Not that I've had it that bad, to be honest with you. But you just kind of, I try my best to to put things in perspective and also take everything with a pinch of salt. You kind of, it's, you know, it's, it is ridiculous having all this security. It is, you know, ridiculous going on these press tour and getting clothes thrown on you and stuff. But I've
clothes. What clothes are thrown at you?
Well, you get like people who decide what you're going to wear and stuff.
Oh, I see. Stylists. I thought you meant the fans were throwing knickers at you or something. Like...
No, that's Tom Jones. I'm nowhere near Tom Jones.
you weren't born too far from him, I don't think.
true. But yeah, so it's been a buzz, and I'm still buzzing off it. And actually, now that the show's been released, you're getting feedback from all the hard work that you've done now, and I think the Dwarves have been well received because they're such an energetic and like domestic breed of peoples that people can relate to. So I think I've been lucky as well to have positive feedback from that.
I suppose as well, you're not a 21-year-old kid who's just got this role. You've been working your nuts off for years, and you know, I'm sure you've had plenty of rejection as well as positive things in your career. And so by the time you get a job like this, you're prepped for it, aren't you? It's not like you go, oh, I'm not sure I can do this, like you might do if you were, you know, there's no imposter syndrome. You're like, I've been busting my balls. I've done the stage. I've done, you know, some TV in Wales, and, you know, I've done all these things, and it's the build up to sticking some prosthetic on and entering the land of the Lord of the Rings, where I'm going to deliver for the director, because I just know I can.
Yeah, this is it. This is it. This is exactly it. Because I have had, like I said earlier, when I first got a job for the National Theatre, it was like, oh my God, this is amazing. This means I'll always have that now. And then you do a Danny Boyle series for Channel 4, and you go, amazing, this surely now will springboard me to something else. And actually it's not. You're only as good as your last omelette. You know, it doesn't mean that. After I did One Man, Two Governors, I had a year of nothing after that, and people saying, oh, this is it, you're made now, you know, you're a leading man in the West End, and it's been getting rave reviews. And actually the reality of it, there isn't a golden bullet that will certify your career, that will make sure that you're going to work for the rest of your life. And that's the attitude I'm bringing to this. So I'm not kind of, actors tend to go, right, what's next? Do you know what I mean? They tend to think, what's coming up next?
I think everyone has to remember that. Even John Travolta had some lean years, didn't he, where people just weren't interested in him. And he was one of the biggest stars in the world. Have you ever read Andy Nyman's book? I've just got it here in front of me, The Golden Rules of Acting That Nobody Tells You. Have you ever read this? Because I cannot recommend this book. It's a tiny little book. But I cannot recommend this book enough, even if you're not an actor. It basically says, don't be a dick. And it says if you're going to turn up and do a job, right, do it properly. Don't call it in, because every bit of it is training for when you get the gig, you know. I've read this book so many times. And thank you, Andy, for that. I love Andy. I think he's a great guy. Because there's so many great bits of advice just in every walk of life, you know. And he talks about getting the buzz of the job and getting the rejection and how you have to work through it all. And that's why it's wonderful when you've done a body of work throughout the whole of your life, and suddenly it ends up with something, a great gig like this. I think it's fantastic, joyous. Tell us about getting One Man, Two Governors, because that, as you say, was a big thing. James Corden had been doing it, hadn't he, for years?
Yeah, that's it. Well, funnily enough, whilst James was at the National doing One Man, Two Governors, and it was, you know, it became this huge success, I was actually outside the front of the National Theatre selling hot dogs on my mate's fast food van.
Brilliant.
And I was just between jobs, and they transferred the show to the West End, and they were looking for an understudy for him. So I think the fact, I'm not going to lie, the fact that I was outside selling hot dogs and had worked for them before, my name got mentioned in the rehearsal room of kind of, I mean, you've got Owen Arthur outside. I mean, get him in. You know, Fred Ridgeway, God rest his soul, him. I'd worked with him doing Comedy of Errors at the Royal Exchange in Manchester. It was him that kind of was gunning for me into Richard Bean, who'd written it. So I went in for the audition and got offered to be an understudy. And my agent at the time was kind of being a snob and kind of going, I don't think you're not an understudy. I don't think you should be doing this. And I said, well, I've not been working for a year. I need a job. And this will give me an opportunity to be a leading man, albeit for four performances in the West End. But I, as an actor, creatively need that. I want that.
Brilliant.
This may never happen again. So I am going to dig deep and swallow my pride, you know, even if you're... For if you think I shouldn't be an understudy. Well, I was more than happy to kind of graft and just have that opportunity. And lo and behold, it worked out. Nick Heitner came to see the play the first time I did it instead of to stand in for James. And he came up to me in the interval and said, listen, I'd love for you to take over the role from James in the West End. And that's what happened. And from then on, you know, I did 9 months in the West End, toured the world, and then came back to the West End to finish it off. So it's like you just
Why the first time you stood in? Why was it? What had happened to James?
Well, they were all planned. I think he was presenting the Brits.
Right. Okay.
At the time, so I knew it was coming. It wasn't like last minute kick bollocks, right. You've got to go on stage. I was prepared for it. And that's why Nick Heitner came to see it. So it's kind of like a live audition in a way.
Were you nervous with understanding that you could do the role and James was going to leave eventually? Everyone knew that. And you were going to, someone had to tell. Was it nerve wracking doing it the first time?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, that night, funnily enough, that night where where I stood in for him for the first time, everyone else around me crumbled because all of a sudden they were looking at this character who wasn't James Corden. And, you know, James Corden got applause when he walked on stage. People were like, well, you know, just because they love James Corden. But that didn't happen for me. Obviously, I had to work harder to win them over. But everyone else just crumbled around me and it was hilarious. Jemima Rooper, I remember handing me, she was supposed to hand me a letter and give it to Ollie Chris. And I'd pick up and she didn't have it in her hand. So I had to, you know, everything was going wrong around me. So it was like I had to pretend to take this letter and go, yeah, thanks, mate, for giving me the letter that's not in your hand. You know, everything just went wrong. People were missing lines. I was, you know, stepping in for them. So it was... And I had to catch a peanut. That was another thing as well. You had to throw a peanut up in the air and catch it in your mouth. And that happened every night. And I caught it. And that was the first night doing it. I caught it. I was so chuffed. I was more nervous about catching a bloody peanut than I was getting all these thousands of lines out.
The thing is, it didn't matter though, does it? Because it's just a good fun play. It's just a laugh, isn't it? It's a farce, and it's just what I loved about seeing it was that everyone, you guys, were just having good fun on the stage, and it didn't feel like anyone was. I'm not saying you weren't working because you were. It's a bit like Sunday brunch. I'm just having fun. I'm working, but I'm having fun. And that's what you look like on the stage. You were just all like, it just looked like I would like to be there having a laugh with these guys who just seem to be amusing themselves. Yeah.
Yeah, that's it. But with the first time you do that, it's very difficult to kind of just go, hey, I don't care if this goes right or wrong.
Yeah.
You know, I had Nick Heitner there, you know, in speech marks, auditioning me in front of 1,500 people, you know. So I was. It's when you're that nervous, it's difficult to kind of not care.
Who's Nick again? Is he the guy who?
Nicholas Heitner was the artistic director of the National Theatre, and he's a very, very intelligent brilliant director, and him and Nick Starr now have opened a theatre called The Bridge in London Bridge, okay. And they continue to do amazing work there.
And who is Fred you mentioned earlier, who suggested you?
Fred Ridgway. Fred Ridgway was an actor. Actually, One Man Two Governors was his last job, and he passed away, unfortunately, with a terminal illness, and yeah, he used to be a stockbroker.
Really?
Oh, yeah, wow. Yeah, in the city, and he was an amateur actor for ages, but he, you know, doing all these amateur plays, he played Hamlet, he played Macbeth, I'm sure he even played Othello once as well. He was a white man. So he just so passionate about it, about acting. He retired, he gave it all up to become an actor, and this is fascinating. To get himself into the industry, he pretended to be his own agent. So he was essentially his own agent, and he called up, I think it was Father Ted, and I don't know if you remember an episode of Father Ted where there was a load of vicars on an aeroplane. Well, he was one of those. He got himself that job to be on that job, just completely selling himself. And I really admire him. He kind of showed me another part of acting, of kind of, yeah, you need to put yourself out there a bit more. And it's something I kind of struggle with, to kind of go, yeah, this is me, I'm good. You know what I mean? You need to, he really sold himself. I thought that was just a stroke of genius. And he sold me to Richard Bean.
That's brilliant. That's fantastic. Yeah. Do you want to hear a good story? So my mate works in the music industry, and he decides that he's going to sign Frank Sidebottom to release some tunes. Yeah. So he goes up to see Frank. Frank turns up with his head on at the door. So he doesn't turn up as whoever's under the mask. I can't remember the name of the guy under the mask now. Anyway, so Frank Sidebottom turns up at the door, and he walks in, and they sit at a table, or I think they even might have gone down into a basement. Anyway. And there's a jelly next to him. It's Frank. So they go to, like, I'm making the figures up here, but it doesn't matter for the story. So they go, look, we want to give you an advance on this single you're going to put out or something. You know, Frank Sidebottom is becoming huge in the club scenes and everything. He's done that stuff.
Yeah.
So he goes, Frank goes, oh, what are you going to give me? And he goes, oh, we're going to give you £10,000. And he said, I need to speak to my agent. Then he leans over and starts talking to the jelly. And then Then he sits up and goes, my agent says it's not enough.
Brilliant.
And my mate said he didn't know what to do because he was just in character. He didn't leave character. So he's just like, I can't remember whether we actually gave him the deal in the end. But I love the idea of just making up you got an agent. And just, I'd like to do that. Yeah. I'd like to pretend I had an agent, and that would be really funny. Yeah. to write. What does an understudy do? I mean, like, apart from obviously stepping in when the main dude is not there or ill or whatever. Yeah. What do you do day to day normally?
Well, I mean, you've got to be show ready. That's the main thing. You've got to kind of work hard, and some understudies don't even get a chance to go on stage. So you've got to know whoever your understudy's role. Sometimes, or most of the times, understudies are actually in the show, moving the set or coming in with a few lines or pretending to be a policeman or something. So you are involved in the show most of the times. But yeah, it is, and there's loads of them in the West End. You know, that kind of turn up every night. I think it's different with musicals. They've all got various tracks and various levels of understudying and stuff. But if you're doing a play, you're usually if you're understudying the main part, you're only understudying that part. But understudies usually will cover about three or four parts, depending on how many actors that are in the play. So it's kind of, you know, you turn up and kind of hang out in the dressing room to go on.
So is that hard then? Because, you know, they all come off, they're all buzzing, they got a standing ovation, and you're like, oh, I didn't do anything tonight sort of thing. Or...
Yeah, do you know what? I absolutely loved it because I had the, when I did it, I had the pressure. I watched James every night. I was in the wings watching him, kind of trying to, you know, because a load of different things were thrown at him. There was improv in the show, and I'd never improvised. James had done stand-up and stuff before. You know, he's so confident and presented stuff. So it was kind of, I was learning from him. And also just having fun with the rest of the cast in the wings, being naughty, doing, you know, watching them being naughty. I absolutely loved it because there was no pressure. I just got to hang out with my mates and then go for beers after the show.
I was going to say that the years ago, there were all those members bars in London that used to, the members bars for the sort of, I don't know, they used to all be for actors, didn't they? When they would finish their shows and then they would stop and lay and there'd be drinking bars basically sort of. There's loads around there which are quite famous. And then I seem to think that people in the West End didn't go out as much for a while, but it's, I don't know, maybe I got that wrong, but it seems that people have started going out again. Is this true? Do you meet up with the other casts?
I mean,
people dressed as cats and stuff. People on roller skates.
Yeah. And lions and giraffes.
Yeah, lions and giraffes. It'd be funny if everyone went out in there. That's what they should do once a year. Everyone should just, all the cast should just go out in their kit and go to a nightclub or something. Yeah, go on. So
that's it. Do you know what? I have to say, with this kind of attitude of enjoy it whilst it's here, I enjoyed the West End whilst it was there as well. And Soho House was kind of, Soho House or the Groucho, they were the venues that we'd go to. That's how Soho House started, apparently. You know, it's this big machine now, isn't it? Of global, dominance. And but it started in Greek Street for actors, for West End, for a place for actors to kind of go and chill out after a show, and it stayed up until 2 or 3, and I was there till 3 brushing up the floors, kind of going, yeah, I'll just help you clean up whilst I finish my whiskey. You know, I worked hard, Tim, but I played hard as well.
Yeah, well, you might as well. I suppose, you know, you had the dream all your life. You said you started at 11, so you're a young boy growing up in Wales. Whereabouts in Wales were you?
I was in, I grew up in a village called Rhiwlas, which is just on the side of a mountain, not far from Snowdon. And I went to school in Bethesda, where my father went to school as well. So it's kind of, it was quite rural. There were 400 pupils in my high school, and it was a Welsh school, Welsh speaking lessons, you know, all my maths and science, and even my English classes were in Welsh sometimes.
Right.
So it was,
is your first language Welsh, or is it English?
Yeah.
Welsh?
No, first language is Welsh, yeah. So I find it difficult when I come down to London, or my parents or my sister comes down to London, and you know the conversation is in English, and then all of a sudden I'm talking to my sister in English. It just feels wrong.
Right. Okay.
Yeah, it's really strange. And I remember cacking it when I first came down to London, actually, because I'd never acted. I did a soap opera for about 9 years before coming down here, and all of a sudden, when I went to drama school, I had to act in English. And it was just the strangest thing. It's like, okay, I think my English is probably better than French is to most people, or German. But it's kind of trying to perform in a different language was something. It took 3 years for me to get used to, definitely.
Was your soap opera Round and Round Around?
That's it.
And so that was on S4C. I know a load of Welsh people, and S4C is huge, obviously, for Welsh people. And was it a big program? Because it must be quite weird when you're like huge in a Welsh speaking. Well, weird for me, because I suppose I'm being rude here because it's like being big in a Spanish thing, isn't it? You're just, but it's kind of part of Britain, so it feels kind of strange, I suppose. But was it big in Wales?
Yeah, it was. It was amongst, because the age, it was targeted for my age group at the time. So it was populous, particularly where I lived, where Welsh was, the dominant language. And therefore, probably like your show, people would watch, there were repeats on Sundays. So people would watch it with hangovers.
So was it like Neighbours or something? Was it like that? Was it for younger people?
It was like Grange Hill. More like Grange Hill meets Hollyoaks, maybe.
Right.
Certainly wasn't Hollyoaks later. But it was...
So were you famous in Wales then?
Well, I was recognised quite often in Wales, and funnily enough, by various generations, by people's grandmas and then 8-year-old children, they'd be like, oh, Aled from Rondarond. And that's all they'd say, because I was a paper boy, and where's my paper? And that was the kind of, that was the thing I had to kind of say, well, I'll get it to you tomorrow, that was the thing that got shouted at me quite a lot, but... But actually, growing up as a teenage boy, with testosterone coursing through your veins and male toxicity and, people wanting to know who the hardest is in class or who's the hardest from whose school and stuff. It was actually quite tough having to play football and just get, it put a target on my back, so I'd get kicked quite a lot, or started on quite a lot when I was out in clubs and stuff. People would just want to give you a black eye so you could have it on telly next week. It was that kind of world.
What made you want to be an actor in the first place? Then what had started this passion for you?
I don't know. I can't put my finger on it. I think I'm kind of giving into the fact now that probably I always wanted to be one. But I refuse to believe that because I really wanted to be a football driver or a racing driver. A football player, sorry. Or a racing driver. But it just kind of... I think I fell into it. I used to perform for my family and kind of do impressions of... I don't know, Michael Jackson, or I'd kind of imitate people and do impressions of people, and it, I'm looking back, watching an 8-year-old boy do that was probably hilarious, and I would kind of go, oh, blood, he's got, he obviously is enjoying this and he's good at it. And they kind of they suggested, it was my grandmother who suggested I'd go to acting classes after school, and again I just thought it just got in the way of me wanting to play football in the park with my mates, but I said okay, go on then, and I enjoyed it. I went there and enjoyed it, and then I got cast to do a play, like a professional play, at the age of 11 in Theatre Gwynedd in Bangor, and then from that producers from Round Our Own, the soap opera, came and watched it and gave me 2 weeks, just a little cameo on the soap opera, and then I was there for 9 years after that. It's kind of, so I fell into it in a way.
But you like to entertain, don't you? I think actors can sometimes struggle when they come on Sunday Brunch because for some of them it's not natural to come on and entertain, but clearly for you, when you came on the show, you were just alive and you just wanted to, you were just enjoying yourself, it looked like, and you wanted to have as much fun as possible, and you were enjoying entertaining, and you loved doing the interview and stuff, and I just thought, that's clearly where you're at, isn't it? Do you prefer theatre or doing... It's a tough question because you probably enjoy doing both, but do you prefer going out where you can actually see the reactions of the people, or do you like doing film?
Well, I have to say, doing One Man, Two Governors, where the reaction was instant and improvising, I love making people laugh. I love having, I mean, I don't like the word banter anymore, but it is, I like communicating with people.
Yeah,
I like figuring out. I like splitting the room as well. Sometimes with a comment that might shock. I'm trying to filter that out of my life now. But
yeah, you're not allowed to do that.
No. Yeah, there are some things I have to be careful with. But I just love communicating. I love laughing because I enjoy it, and I like making other people laugh. And I think that probably stems to when I was doing Michael Jackson. As a child, and making my mum laugh, do you know what I mean? I love bringing joy to the table, and I enjoy other people who like to deal with that as well.
When I was doing my research on you, I brought up a newspaper article, which I thought was great because you're obviously known in Wales, and it was a Welsh newspaper, I can't remember which one now, and they were saying, but whilst he's doing acting, he's also learning the knowledge as well. You know, you can become a London cabbie. And I thought, that's brilliant that you were going, okay, right, shit, I need to go and get some work here. So, you know, if nothing's coming in, I'm going to go and earn a living. You said you did some labouring as well. So there must have been, it must feel quite a long time ago since you've been doing the press of the Lord of the Rings stuff, that you must have felt quite not insecure, but you must have felt like, well, I'm not sure I'm going to earn a living out of this. I need to maybe become a London cabbie or something.
Yeah, that's exactly it. A mate of mine who's a session drummer, Ali, and he's a cabbie, and you know he like I said, he's a session drummer, so he'll go and do gigs now and again. You can't really make a living out of that. Well, you can, I suppose, but he, you know, I think he had 4 or 5 kids to feed, and I looked at it as a great thing to have as a backup plan. It was just a backup plan, really. And also, I like driving, and this was before we had Google Maps and Waze and stuff, so you had to look up an A to Z to see where you're going. And I just, I don't know if it was a thirst for knowledge, but. Or if it's a Welsh thing of working, you know, getting yourself set up and having a backup plan. I don't know what it is, if it's a work ethic thing. I just don't know. But I just saw it as the perfect thing to accommodate my ambition of wanting to be an actor. And having something to support that, basically. And I gave it a good whack as well. I did it for a good year. I passed the mock test, but fortunately or unfortunately, I don't know, I still kind of wish I had it as a backup plan.
Do you know what? When I used to go and get my hair cut when I had hair, I used to go and get it cut, and the barbers, always in my local barbers, they were all like the younger people, and I used to always say to them, you know, what are you doing? You know, they didn't feel right, and there was like a group of them, 4 or 5 of them in this barbers who were all actors, and they'd all learned to be barbers whilst they were waiting for new roles to come in, which I thought was just such a great idea, because they say, you know, they could just get a chair when they needed work and whatever else. Yeah, so I thought that was clever.
Let's do that with your mates as well.
Yeah, exactly. You can always make a few quid. You know, Bob Mortimer, didn't he do that? Wasn't he? There's this great story. I think it was on What I Lie to You. It's definitely in his book, I think, where he went to the World Cup and he was cutting people's hair for beer or something. I don't know. let's get back to the Rings of Power. Can I ask you a couple of cliche questions? I think the listeners would like to know. First one is the prosthetics. Took you a long time to get those on, didn't it?
Yeah, it did. It did, yeah. So I played Durin the Fourth. As at this moment in time, he's the Prince of Khazad Dûm, and I've got a prosthetic nose and prosthetic ears, and then on top of all of that, then I've got this massive beard and a wig to put on.
Yeah,
and it's a 2.5. It's 3 hours in total, 2.5 sat in the chair to put all the bits and bobs on, and then kind of massive rush then to put the clothes on. So it's a 3-hour call to put all of this stuff on. Yeah.
What's that like then? Because you, I mean, I imagine that's quite. Yeah, again, you're not digging holes in the road, but I imagine that's quite a. It must be quite exhausting just sitting in a chair for 3 hours doing nothing, and then you've got to go and perform.
Absolutely. So again, with that mentality of I'm not digging holes in the road, and you know, I'm not working for the NHS. There are far worse jobs to be had, but to be able to, like you say, to perform and kind of survive the day, because this thing is so intrusive on your face. And as much as they, you know, they as respectful as they were, the makeup artist and the prosthetic artist all day, they constantly had to touch you up as well, and the itch and the heat and all of that stuff. It's a discipline. It certainly is. And I caught myself, I don't know if I was meditating or not, but taking really deep breaths, closing my eyes and kind of really focusing on calming myself down. It sounds a little bit pretentious now when I'm looking back on it, but it was something I really had to do to keep myself focused and not lose my mind. And so it was definitely a new discipline that I've now learned. And thinking of going to shoot the second season now, I'm instantly picturing myself or putting my brain in a certain headspace to survive it, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
And to be able then to embrace it and make it a part of me, a part of my face, a part of my character, to then go forward with it and behave like it's not even there. You know, that's something also that you're contending with, whilst also embracing some parts of it, like the length of the beard is something that character has to deal with. So I've got to get right. Okay, so this is the thing I'm allowed to be aware of. The fact that it itches like mad, I can't really, it's not part of the story, you know, just to have an itchy beard. So it's, I mean, don't get me wrong, Tim, I absolutely love it. I absolutely love that I have to sit in that chair for 2.5 hours, suffer as I may. I really, really love it because it's playing, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's kind of, the acting's for free. All the other stuff is what you get paid for. That's the kind of the motto is that's kicking around at the moment for me.
And just so we don't get any criticism, in defence of digging holes in the road, and I've done a bit of labouring. The camaraderie on building sites, I really love that. I was just crap at it because I was so weak, and I'm. A few times I've done jobs for strong where you got to be strong, and I'm just not that way inclined. But I did really enjoy it. So I mean, when we're using that example, it's not criticizing that job.
No, definitely not. And it's the exhaustion of it all. It's the kind of you have to do. You can't. You know, it's you're out in all weathers. You're next to a dangerous road. You know what I mean? It is exhausting.
Just explaining what privileged ponces we are by doing a job where we're inside, basically having fun. So,
exactly.
Does being Welsh feel special then? I think from us looking on, the fact that you have a language that is just so alien to the rest of Britain, it does feel very special. Does it feel that way for you?
Do you know what? I'm constantly surprised of how many people don't know that Welsh is my first language, our people's first language. It's like you go to France and you learn, oh, bonjour, merci, you know, comment appelez-vous, and you kind of, we know bits of Welsh, but actually when people come to Wales, they don't know to say hello, simai, diolch, os gwelwch yn dda, you know, thank you, and yes, if you please. So I'm surprised at it because I grew up with it. It's my world. It's Wales. I'm ridiculously proud, and I think every Welshman you see, particularly when they either cross the border or go to a different country, every Welshman will fly the flag because of the pride we have for our country and our language, and we're such a small nation that and it's so special that we have our own language, we have our own channel, we have you know, it's our identity, it's me, I'm so patriotic of and proud of being Welsh that yeah, it does feel special. Particularly when you bump into a Welsh speaking person away from Wales, you kind of go, oh, it's so rare. And actually, what's so special about working on Rings of Power is that you've got Morvid Clark, who plays Galadriel, and Tristan Gravel, who plays Farazon. That's three Welsh people in The Lord of the Rings, The Rings of Power. And that blows my mind. The fact that all three of us can speak Welsh is it just blows my mind even further and makes it really, really special. And I don't know, that kind of, I suppose, adds to the magic of working on this show as well, having that.
When you're speaking Welsh to each other, what's the reaction of everybody else around you?
Well, they just have no idea. They have no idea what language we speak. But now and again, we'll kind of say, "Spiar a llawr yn y fanna, concrete ydi hwnna." And you go, "Did you just say concrete?" "Yep, I just said concrete." So we'll have. Well, you know, we'll use English words for stuff.
When I used to tour with bands, there used to be a gig in, I think it's Cardiff, you know, and bearing in mind South Wales, there's a lot of people who just only speak English, aren't there? And that's where my ex-wife came from and all her relatives. None of them spoke Welsh. But in Cardiff, there's a Welsh-speaking venue there, and I can't remember what it's called now. And when you go in there, I was always like...
Club Ivor Bach.
Right. And so being English, I used to go in there and then they'd all be speaking. And even I could not get my head around it because we did in those days hear so little about Wales and the Welsh language that I'd be sitting there going, they're speaking a different language. It was such a shock to me that people would do that. You know, it's like, it's so strange. And it's so wonderful that it still exists. Isn't it growing as well at the moment, the Welsh language, I heard?
I feel yes, I think it is. There was when I was 17, when I was roughly 17, 18, there was a dip in the amount of people who spoke it first language, and I think it was my generation actually who reverted to English more. Now I think those people wish they spoke Welsh and therefore are putting their children into Welsh speaking schools.
Right.
So I think that might be a second wind that's happening. I could be completely wrong, Tim. I don't know. I don't hold the stats on this, but
no.
I feel like it is something that Welsh people now identify as being very special, and a part of being Welsh.
And by the way, the beaches in Wales are off the scale. The landscape is unbelievable, as we know. You mentioned Stone and stuff earlier, but the Gower beaches are just absolutely incredible. They are so beautiful. The countryside there is phenomenal, and it's just beautifully green and amazing place. Amazing, So, all right, one other thing, talking about scenes, beautiful scenes. One thing you told me on Sunday brunch was a lot of the acting you did in the scenes, they had actually built the stuff. That must be so exciting as well, because I just assumed you would just be doing the whole thing in front of green screen. But it's not been like that, has it?
No. That it was, and not just, it just blew my mind. Tim, let me tell you, the artistry that's gone into the show is incredible. And the scale of the pure scale of the sets blows your head. And then you go on into the other worlds, like you'll go to a place called Numenor, and that then is, they've literally built an entire city. you know, a town nicer than most town centres you'll ever visit. And then you'll go to a massive forest, and they've built trees and handcrafted leaves, and it's just mind-boggling the amount of work and that's gone into it. And you couldn't be anywhere other than Middle Earth as well, particularly on my set. I call it my set because it's my kingdom, Tim. Everything the light touches.
That's amazing.
It really is
beautiful.
Incredible.
It's beautiful to watch, though, isn't it? I've watched the first episode because you came on my show, and I was just like, I was blown away by the scale of it all. It's so amazing to watch. Tolkien's mind to create these things in the first place is something else. It's quite a special mind he must have had.
Yeah, well, this is, I mean, the detail and the vastness of the world that he's created. I mean, you only need to look at, you know, the first two episodes of our show, well, three episodes, because then you get Numenor, to see that the detail, everything that's on set, on the costumes, on the CGI, because the artistry that's gone into creating the vastness of the CGI world is very spectacular as well. And all of that has come from the source materials, come from all the books and dependencies as well. So it is incredible that all of this has come from one guy's mind.
Yeah. Listen, I know I've taken up a lot of your time. I just got a couple of questions. I used to ask all my guests. I stopped. And I've gone back to it now. Just asking three or four questions at the end. Three questions. So the first one is: what's one piece of advice that's been invaluable to your life? You can tell our listeners to help them with their lives.
I think we've touched upon it today, Ashley, and it's work hard and be nice to people. That's something I always try and reference myself to, and whenever I get success or if something good comes to my life, I always refer to it. That's because I've worked hard and I've been nice to people, and you might not get an instant result from it, but it's so. I mean, I can't think of any other way to live.
Pays off in the end. Pays off.
So.
Yeah,
I think so.
Yeah. Have you ever seen a UFO or a ghost?
No.
Oh. I'm not obsessed. Yeah, that's why I ask all the time. I'm not obsessed with ghosts. I like the principle of them. I like the concept. I like the fact there's so many people out there who say they've seen one. I don't think people are liars. So there's something in it, and I don't know what it is because I don't believe in ghosts, but I believe there's something people think they're seeing, whatever. But the UFO thing, I'm mad on. I spend far too much of my life reading about UFOs. I'm just absolutely obsessed with it. I can't stop reading about it. I'm going to start a podcast on it, I swear, because I just want to.
You should.
I just love reading all about it. I think it's a lot of it's bollocks, but there's some of it there which I do like. And wouldn't you just love one day you wake up in the morning, it gets to about 11 o'clock, and suddenly you start looking at your phone, and one of your mates is going, fucking hell, turn the news on. And it's like a UFO has landed in the White House lawn or something. Wouldn't you just love that? You'd be like, our world would change just boof overnight. We'd be seeing something new.
I know. And actually, do you know what? I think if a UFO would land on Earth,
yeah.
I'm not saying one hasn't already.
If you read the stuff that I've read.
Right. Right. Wouldn't do you think the world would change? Like the war that's going on, the fighting over fuel, all these awful, inhumane things that are happening in our world now. Would that put everything into perspective? And we would, here we go, we're going back to Lord of the Rings, we'd all join forces and
to fight the orcs.
Well, to fight the orcs, yeah, but you know, kind of put all our differences apart, and just be, the world might be a more peaceful place.
I so 100% agree with you, and I think that would happen. If anyone out there doubts UFOs, by the way, if you really want to get, like, I'd be careful though, because if you do this, it might open up a world to you, and then you might not be able to stop like me. But there was a school in a place called Rua, Zimbabwe. And 62 students saw a UFO land and then a creature, which was kind of one of the greys, as they call them, with the big eyes, came out. And I don't think he said that they did. I've seen different things on it, but I don't think he said anything. He just telepathically put into all these 62 kids, right? Zimbabwe, so the black and white kids and teachers, black and white teachers, put it in their minds that he went, "You're ruining your world." I'm laughing because they just "You're ruining your world," and then they got and flew up. But when they went and interviewed these kids, they all drew exactly the same thing. Now, knowing children as we do, it's pretty tough to get 62 kids on the same page to believe in UFOs and draw exactly the same thing. And they've gone back and interviewed them all, and they've said, "Yeah, it happened." So that's where, after seeing that, was where I really started going, "Oh, I'm into this." I mean, but be careful if you go and look that up, because you'll start believing like me.
It's a rabbit hole.
You'll end up down that rabbit hole, and you'll be looking around, going, "Hold on a second, there's more to this than meets the eye." Also, talking about your mate James Corden, are you mates with him, by the way? He's a good guy, isn't he? I like James.
Yeah, absolutely.
Whatever happened to him with his world domination? But he had Barack Obama. I mean, listen, James Corden ends up interviewing Barack Obama. Barack Obama on James Corden's show says there's definitely UFOs. We just don't know what they are. And it's like, it wasn't front page news. I've gone up a key. I'm that excited about it. But it's like, well, why the hell? I trust Barack Obama. I don't think he's lying to us. So, you know, he's saying there are there, but we just don't know what they are. So they're either Chinese, Russian, or aliens, whatever. I don't know. Last question. I'll stop talking about you. We'll go on for another hour just talking about UFOs. meanwhile, you're kind of come off this podcast. And go, I just did a podcast with Tim Lovejoy. He's absolutely lost the plot, by the way. He's mad on UFOs. Final question.
I love it.
What is the final question? Is what is the meaning of life?
Oh, what is the meaning of life? Live it. Just live it. Just live it. Live your life.
Yeah.
I think that's what I'm doing at the moment. Ask me in 10 years' time, it'll probably be different. But just live your life, but don't harm others. I mean, there's so many. It's really hard to pinpoint. What do you say to that? What is the meaning of life?
Well, that's why I keep on asking you lot to make sure I can try and find out. But I like that, because I think the meaning of life has to be something quite simplistic, like people say love and stuff like that. Just be. Mm. But I think living is just, there's a lot of people who are not living. You know, and I think so. Yeah. The idea that you're living is important. You know, and
I think so.
So I think it's a great way of leaving it as well. So, listen, thank you so much for doing the podcast today. Thoroughly enjoyed that. I reckon we could have done a 3-hour podcast there.
I reckon so too.
Keeping an hour was good. Yeah. So thank you so much for joining me. Cheers.
Nice one, mate.